All right, at this time I would like to introduce our speaker for the day, who will speak till 10:10, and then he will answer any questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Mike from Anaheim.
Mike, alcoholic. Okay, I got a timer here. Taking a breath. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to speak here. Mary asked me about a month ago, so I've had plenty of time to get in my head about what I'm going to speak about. But first of all, I like the decorations that you put up for me. It reminds me of a bar that I used to drink at, except the lights were a little lower. Let's see. Welcome the newcomers who identified. You know, I was nervous, and I was just telling Mary right before. I was nervous when I was sitting there, and when Julius started talking, and then Mary started talking, I got at ease, and I identified what that was. It's because the God in me recognized the God in you, and I got a little emotional on both of your shares, because I identify. And if you get anything out of what I say, it's not the stories that were the same or whatever, it's the feelings that we had around them. Also, I'd like to thank my friends who are here. A lot of you I've known for a long time, but you haven't heard this part of... I share in a general way all the time. I share about gratitude, and that's where I am. My sobriety day is March 6, 1992. So that's 21 years. I took it a couple months ago. Over the years, I found it just easier for me to share about gratitude because I want you to hear about that. But I think it's also important to identify so you know that everything that I'm sharing is so wonderful, it wasn't always that way, you know. So let's see. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'm going to say a couple things and start early because I think they're pertinent to who I am as a person. It's the baggage that I started picking up along the way as a kid and everything. So let's just get into it. When I was 5 years old, my mom and my dad divorced, and there was three kids. So we were like 3, 5, and 7 years old. So I don't have any really earlier memories of my dad before that time. He was just gone. And mom, so this is how this started. Mom started working two jobs to support us. So we didn't have a lot of mom or dad around at that time. So thank God for grandma and grandpa. My earliest memories are happiest when I got to go. We took turns going to grandma and grandpa's house. We'd go one at a time and everything. And my grandma was the model of unconditional love, and I really liked to go. I felt special. My grandma and grandpa, is awesome. At home, you know, I heard Jenny share about being a middle child, and I'm like, me too, you know. I was the middle boy. Just a little memory from that is because mom was working so much, I remember my first memory of kind of like being a little different or I didn't have the same as the other kids had is in kindergarten when my neighbor had to stand in for my mom and everybody's folks were there and everything and the neighbor lady who has kids the same age as us and who we spent a lot of time with early on. You know, there was a couple of instances like that. So anyway, speed up a little bit. So my mom remarried. One day she came home and she said, this is Norm. He'll be moving in with us, you know. And, okay. I didn't know who this was. And at that time, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that they were engaged or where that was going. I think mom waited till she was sure and everything before she introduced us. Now I said there was three of us boys and me being the middle child, but by the time my mom remarried, I had a sister too. So that's not my story, that's my mom's story. So I'll leave it at that. So we were living in Carson at the time. Carson, San Pedro, that area over there. Which is not really a real nice area, and I thank God we got out of there. So when my mom and dad married, I say dad because my stepdad is my dad. And see how easy it came right there. I don't have to back up. So this man, they got married and everything. And so this is your stepfather. And within the first year, he moved us over to Orange County. And so we got out of there. So I did elementary school at Carroll-Dale Elementary School. And I remember the teachers and I remember the crowd. And I remember I was the lightest one there, you know. So anyway, we moved to Orange County and everything. And so I was already an awkward kid feeling, you know, not feeling like I'm getting enough attention and everything. And so when my mom remarried and my dad moved us to a new area, I wanted his acceptance and his love. And so I became the best little kid that I could become. I checked out the rules. I checked out what he said. And I did, and I started getting the best grades and really studying, and then my brothers would get into trouble, and they got the attention, I didn't. So anyway, this just kept on going all the way through. I was just a good kid. When I became a teenager and everything, it was funny, my stepdad, he was strict, and he wasn't very touchy-feely emotional and everything. And it took a good 3 years for us to warm up. And I remember when we finally asked him, can we call you dad? And that is, I don't remember a lot, but I remember things that imprint with a feeling or emotion. When he became my dad, now I'll refer to him as dad now, I still wanted to do the best I could. You know, he married my mom with four kids. He moved us to Orange County for us to get a better life and everything. And so I didn't realize all this of what he took on until I became an adult. But he'd be strict. And so we'd be school shopping and everything. And we'd remember those little blue tennis shoes or Keds or whatever with the white stripe on it. That's what we would get for school. Now, if we wanted anything else like Reeboks like the other kids had, we had a kick in ourselves. So 13, I got a paper route job. 14, I was working in a Chinese restaurant, Ginkong Mongolian Barbecue. I was cooking up there at 14 years old. 15, I was working at a gas station. And by 15, I bought a car. Now, I'm not getting in trouble. I am doing everything. Brothers are all getting in trouble. But right now, you know, I bought the car on my own. I didn't ask for any help. And it started a lot of, who I am now, my work ethic and being self-sufficient and everything. And I didn't start out meaning to be that way. It's just how it happened. So I had my own car at 15 and I snuck it out of the house. At 15 when nobody was home, and it was stick shift, and I've never driven a stick, and I don't know what I was thinking, you know, because there's hills by my house, and so the first hill, I'm like, uh-oh, I'm rolling back, what do I do? Anyway, I got out of it, I didn't wreck the car, and at 16, I had my first drink. Let me back up a second. I had a couple of sips here and there. I never really got anything out of it, parties, family gatherings, whatever. But at 16, around Christmas time, my friend Donnie, who became, I've known him now for 40-something years. We met in fourth grade when I came to Orange County. So at 16, we're still hanging around and nobody's home. And so we hit the liquor cabinet. Now, I think I heard somebody share about you take a little out of all of them so they don't really notice. So we mixed this thing with like eight different alcohols and added Christmas cookies onto that because there was tons of Christmas cookies. And let me just tell you, Christmas cookies and that much booze doesn't mix. But I was feeling great at first, and I remember that feeling, and I wasn't, at that time, I wasn't worried about anything until the Christmas cookies came back. you know, and this is kind of how it went and all in high school, I got good grades. I was the kid that worked in the cafeteria because I want to make my dad not have to pay for my lunches and stuff like that. I want to be self-sufficient. I worked in the office. I did all these different things, you know, kind of almost like the AV guy with the cart, but not that bad. you know, and by this point, I mean, I always wanted them to just acknowledge me or whatever, but at this point, I stopped really kind of caring and just started living for me, you know. So at 17, 16, 17, 18, I started working in fast foods, and by 17 and a half, 18, they offered me a management position. I'm going to school at this time. I'm getting good grades, but I'm only going half the time. I'm ditching, just like my brothers, but they're all getting caught. I'm not getting caught. I did it a little smarter. You know, when you work in the office, you can kind of get little passes to pull people out of class and everything. Me and Donnie both worked in the office, and so we both get each other out of class and leave for the day. At 16, 17, Donnie went to Hawaii to visit his sister. When he came back, he introduced me to pot. Now, that's not a big part of my story because I didn't like it. I really didn't like it. And at 16, there's not many places you could do it without getting in trouble and everything. And so I was still trying to stay under the radar. But by 18, I became pretty self-sufficient, had a management job, I had money, and then my parents were trying to tell me, you know, what I needed to do, and school's ending, and what you need to do, and I'm like, wait, I got money, I can move out, and I did. I moved out at 18 years old. Let me stop for a second. There's so many other things along the way that I was going to say, but I'm already past it, so I won't go back. So by 18, we moved in. There's four of us. We moved into a place. And this is where things escalated. 18 till about 21, it became drinking nightly. It became games of quarters with Bacardi 151. And the goal was to see who was the last one standing. I don't know if anybody knows about quarters or whatever. But you had to get really good or you're going to get really drunk. I didn't think that was a problem. There was one of us in the group that would drink so much and stumble around and never fall or never pass out. It was the one that I would say was an alcoholic. The one that would walk over to the corner and think he's in the bathroom. You know, Oh, I didn't even push my timer. Look at that. Now I'm lost. I planned this for a long time to have a timer here because I sometimes would go long. So, okay. Wow. Now I got to speed up because it's going fast. Okay, reset my timer. Let me just fast forward. So when I was 16, 17, I dated a girl named Charlotte. She was just one of the friends, one of the groups that we worked with and everything. Let me back up again. This morning, I was talking to my partner, and we're talking about what I'm going to share about. And I'm like, you know, I think I'm going to treat it like a game of Yahtzee. I'm putting all my dice in a cup. I'm shaking it, out it comes. And so this is it, okay? I even have notes of what I want to say. I'm not even looking at it. This is Yahtzee, okay? So when I was 21 years old, I started dating a beautiful woman named Allison. Because all my friends thought she was gorgeous, they all wanted her, and then I got to date her and everything. So at this time, I didn't realize that. I started to realize that this is not what I wanted out of life. Whether I wanted to admit it or not, my preference was men. And so, instead of doing that at home and having to introduce people to my family. I moved out. I moved to LA. I went up there, and from, I know I have to go faster now. So from 21 to 25, I went to, I met a lot of people. I went to the fancy parties. I was living the life that I thought that I wanted and everything until it just wasn't working anymore. I was introduced along the way to a lot of different dry goods, the cousins, as we call it, and everything. But they never really took because I didn't want to buy it, you know. Unless you had it, then okay, you know. At 25 years old, and I got to get to this part because this is where it hit bottom for me. I grew up so feeling independent. I'll do what I want. I can make my own decision. I can try anything once and make a decision from there. And boy, was I wrong. At 25 years old, I did another dry good, also known as crack cocaine. So now we're about over. 25 to 27 was a rocket ship down. From the first time I touched that, I didn't have a choice anymore. And I think that a lot of people can relate to in whatever it was that took you. Where it took me, and I didn't even get to talk about it, I didn't think I had trouble with the law and everything, but I was counting. It's like I was arrested a few different times and had scrapes and car accidents and things along the way, but I got out of it every time. And so, you know, right before it all ended, I sold my car, the one that I worked really hard to earn and everything, to continue doing what I was doing. And that lasted me one night with whatever I got for that car. And so I turned around the next day, actually at 3 o'clock in the morning, and stole that car back because I didn't get a fair deal. So I didn't talk about the other arrests and everything, but each arrest and everything, I got out of it and everything. And that one I got out of too, because my name was, they took me to jail, were booking me with Grand Theft Auto, and then they're like, your name's on the registration, and they were confused, and they put a court date, and it got dismissed. I'm like, I could add Grand Theft Auto. I could add Grand Theft Auto on there. Out of all my arrests, none of it really went on my record. I was arrested when I was 18 for pot, and I didn't even like pot, but I was entrepreneurial and I was selling it, you know. I got pulled over with seven little baggies, 7/8 and everything, and they were trying to get me for distribution of over an ounce. And I was in jail, and I was thinking, because I'd like math and everything, I'm like, we smoked one bag, and that's 7/8. That means that's partial of an ounce. And I'm like, hey, weigh it without the bags, you know. because I weighed it on a triple beam scale, so I know what it was, you know. And I got out of that one, too. One of the blackouts I want to go and tell you about, it was a club called Confetti's, and I was 21 years old, right before I was 21 years old, and they had $2 Long Island iced tea night. And I had 20 bucks, so, you know, I was ready to party. All I remember, really, well, I remember walking in and Dead Alive was playing on the music and everything. And the next thing I remember, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm a block away on the freeway in the fast lane with my car off, lights off, and key off. And I opened my eyes and it's like somebody hit me with the adrenaline. It's like, you know, I could have been hit, died, killed somebody else. And I recently heard about somebody who admitted to drinking and killed a family of whatever. That really could have been me several times along the way. Thank God. You know, God watches out for drunks and fools. And he was working double duty with me because I was both. The things I did and you know, it's amazing that I'm standing here. I'm pulling up my little security blanket just in case I got the 10-minute warning. And I heard Jenny say, oh, you're right. It does kind of go faster than I expected. So anyway, I'm getting sober. I'm now running from the police. I jumped off a two-story building and everything. It was like an episode of Cops with, you know, it's kind of like the camera down with showing, chasing a person. I'm on, like on the news or whatever. But anyway, I walked into something that was going on with the cops, but I was paranoid. I was high. I was whatever. So I ran. I had no need to run, but I ran, you know, because I recognized that and a couple of people. All of a sudden, I hear 10 different, like, pursuits of foot and car and helicopter. And I was just terrified, and I ran, and I jumped off of a two-story building to get away, and I got away, and I crushed my heel in the process. I had to jump far enough to miss the shish kebab, the spear type of a gate, and then land, and then crush my heel in a pair of shoes that weren't even mine. They were a size too small. So I crushed my heel, and I got taken to the hospital, and then they discharged me because I didn't have insurance, whatever, but they put a cardboard splint on me. Anyway, a few days later, I was in surgery. I wish I had more time for this because this is a really good story. And then they ended up putting several pins in my heel. I'm still living in crack houses. I haven't lived anywhere but crack houses or on the street for 25 to 27 years old. And I don't know how I got to that point because I was pretty independent. But you know what? I wasn't thinking about anything except next one, you know, more. What do I need to do to keep going the way I was going? I ended up Salvation Army. You know, I skipped a big part. My grandma took care of me for 6 months when when nobody else would. And she fed me unconditional love and everything. And what happened there, that jumping off the building, I thought was my bottom, the incomprehensible demoralization, but it wasn't. It was a little while later, after 6 months of my grandmother caring for me, and I'm off my crutches at 5 months, and I'm walking with a limp and everything. I walked to the store to get a pack of cigarettes, and then there was somebody there. You know, and at this point, I was sober by my own accord. I don't know what AA is, you know. And then in a few days, I was back as bad as I was, living in my grandma's house. And the bottom for me was I took $20 out of my grandma's purse, the woman who I love more than anybody. And that was more to me than jumping off the building and almost dying. And the police turned around saying, "We're not paying for this one," and left me there. That's the expanded story, but I knew I had to do something. So I reached out, I called my mom because she already had all the recovery houses in line. And that was March 5th, 1992. Actually, it was March 6th, my sobriety date, so that Sunday. So it was March, yeah. It was March 5th. And by Monday, I was checked into the Salvation Army. And I have this here, and I brought this here. I lost everything I had before this point. Any school books, any memories, anything that I had achieved up to this point were lost in the process, and I lost in moving and everything. And this is the first thing that I have had the longest that still survived, and it's my badge to the Salvation Army, because I went there, and it's really good memories there, and that's my first newcomer chip. And I like to say that I haven't had to go back out there and retry the things. What I found here in Salvation Army, so anybody's in a recovery house or anybody that's new, you're in the right place. I believe if I didn't go to that recovery house, I would not be sober today. That recovery house gave me a foundation built on old-timers and newcomers and everything like that. And my first meeting was there. I did like 180 meetings, and I mean, because it was a six-month program, and we're going two times a day. I wasn't counting that. I didn't know that, you know, I was going to brag about it later. but I met my first sponsor there and everything, and he took me through the steps back up. My first meeting, somebody walked around and said, "There's 50 of you in here. Five of you will be sober. The rest of you will be drunk." And I had my first resentment in AA. Because I'm stubborn, and I'm going to be one of those five. And so I worked the steps. I worked one through four. Four was hard to get to because four was hard to work because there's a lot of emotion and a lot of things that was dredging up that I had been masking for so long that I don't want to look at right now. But I did it, and I was emotionally raw and everything. We're getting ready to work my fifth step, and he relapsed. My sponsor relapsed. And I'm like, abandonment issues all coming back all at once, you know. So what did I do? I graduated that program at 6 months, and I stayed on my fourth step. I'm not going to share it with anybody, or that's what I was thinking at the time. So I went a year and a half like this. I got a job after I got out of rehab, and I thought it was a get-well job, but it led me to where I was going. It was in Arco Oil Refinery. I was pipe fitter helper. I was hired as, but they soon found I had more knack for arranging the drawings in the office anyway. So I started doing that, and I was introduced to computers, and that's in the field that I'm in right now. Between those jobs, I went back to school. I went and took class. I got certifications in the area in computers. So now in my sobriety, there's no time to go through all the miracles that have happened for me. I got in a 15-year relationship. On my second year, I got involved with somebody that had 6 months. And it lasted as long as it lasted. And I've had to make some hard choices in my sobriety. And one of those was to end that relationship at 13 years. Started at 13 years because he relapsed. He was drinking and hiding. And we have a son, that relationship came with a five-year-old who I got to raise as a father, and we're still close today. More so than his biological father. Anyway, so I got to do that, but I had to end that relationship. If I wanted to stay sober, I had to do that for me. So I've had so many miracles happen. Okay, I know that I'm running out. Oh, okay. So I didn't know how many little warnings I was going to get. Okay, so 3 minutes. Let me tell you, my dad, who was strict, who was all those things, is key in my sobriety. Because somewhere along at 10 years, when I stopped trying to get everybody to accept me and congratulate me for doing a good job and this and that, out of the blue, he tells me, he goes, "I'm proud of you." And I started crying, and I'm like, I didn't know I needed that. I didn't know I needed that, but the kid in me needed that. The kid in me was looking for that for all those years. And my dad got sick, had a heart attack, and then they said he only had like 6 months to live, you know, and so we started, it just opened up, and we had a whole new relationship. He lived for 9 years. He said 6 months, you can't listen to that and everything. But what that did is it gave us 9 awesome years that I have had a relationship with my dad, who now we bond and he's proud of me. We can tell each other we love you and everything. And that's probably the key. What that is an example to me of this program. And then I got this in this program. The last couple of days before he died, he was in a hospice in a table or the bed in his living room, because it was not going to be good. So let him be comfortable in his home and everything. And I got to be there, holding his hand as he's can't talk anymore. He's still lucid, but he can't talk, and slowly that started drifting away. But he holding his hand. Just minutes before he passed away, we're locked eyes and staring. And I'm like feeling like I'm having a conversation with him, because all the things that we didn't say or did say, or pride, or it's okay for me to go and everything. I don't know if it's God or whatever is talking to me. And that's what I really needed to hear. And so at 15 to 17, I lost my grandma, my dad, my relationship, my dogs, my kid moved out. 15 to 17 years of sobriety was really tough for me, but what I learned in these rooms from you people is how to get through those things and how to do them sober. How was told to me early, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, and I try to bring that to everything that I do. In all my affairs, I didn't have to go to this. I got so many other things that I wanted to say. To thine own self be true. That's probably one of the biggest things that I want to go and say to you. Today, I am proud of the person I am. I'm in a relationship that's now 2.5 years. It's built on love's program and mutual respect. I'm living the life that I never thought that I could live. And how to do it is just get into unity, service, and recovery. You know, recovery is in the big book and the 12 and 12. Unity within the traditions and anything that you do, reaching out, talking to a newcomer, picking up ashtrays, not anymore, or butt cans or whatever, is being of service. So I've been of service. Every year of my sobriety, and if I can give anything to you, if you want to stay sober, is dive into that. You're going to hear, you're going to find what we found here as you trudge that road to happy destiny. I had so much more I was going to go and say, but my sobriety is based on gratitude. If you don't hear anything else in here, is I want you to hear the gratitude, because there's always something to be grateful for. If my house burnt down, I have the foundation it was built on where I can start over. If you put conditions on what will make you drink, or under what conditions you can stay sober, you're going to drink, because people will die, relationships will end, things will happen. That's life on life's term. What this program has given me is a way to be able to live that way on life's terms. Thanks.
Question and answers?
Too busy. busy. Mike alcoholic. Anybody have a question?
What were your thoughts as you were jumping from that two-story building?
You know, it's like I said, it was like an adrenaline needle hit me, whatever. It was flight or fight, and all I knew was I had to get away. And it really, I didn't think about what was going to happen. My only thought was to clear the bar so I didn't end up stuck on the top, you know, shish kebabbed, you know. When I hit the ground, I knew that was a mistake. Basically, I had to be laid on my back to look up, and I think I've shared about that before.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that any routine that I do every single day, there's several things. One thing is to talk to an alcoholic every single day. Whether it's somebody I'm in a relationship, somebody I'm working with, going to meetings and being of service, and somehow it's just staying connected to AA. I mean, I don't make it too difficult. I don't see, is there a hand over there? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
Jerry. Hi,
Jerry. About your first sponsor getting drawn, you got another sponsor?
Yeah, you know, I started running out of time right there. What I wanted to go and tell you is that at a year, thank you for bringing that up, that at a year and a half that the pain got too great and everything, that I needed to dump that fifth step. And so I had, So I had heard somebody from a podium speak in the hospital meeting in Laguna. And he talked about after a night of drinking and incomprehensible demoralization or whatever happened to be going, he woke up with a pink shirt on and nothing else. No shoes, no drawers, no nothing. And he had to make it home 2 miles away. So he tells a story about running, and he's 6'4" black man, okay? And a big black man. And he tells a story about running over to get to his house and everything. And I said to myself, he can hear my fifth step. So Ed sponsored me for 15 years, and I got connected to 12 other guys that he was sponsoring at the time, and it gave us a group, a fellowship, a pack that I could tell anything to, and that was key. And so thank you for that question. Any more?